Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to LSE. This is the second day of term, so also Happy New Year and welcome back from the festive break. My name is Eva Michaela. I teach at the Law Department. My work is on the infrastructure for financial markets, and therefore I'm delighted to this evening welcome Chairman Massad from the Commodity Futures and Trading Commission. Chairman Massad was sworn in as a chair on the 5th of June 2014, and he was sworn in after he was confirmed by the United States Senate as the chair and as a commissioner of the CFTC. Before taking that role, he had an eminent role as the assistant secretary, and he was at the Department of Treasury, and he oversaw the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and that was a program that after the financial crisis put money into the economy to bring it back on track. And so he was responsible for the everyday management of those funds and for the recovery. And he made a profit, so he recovered more money for the government than the government put in. Prior to working for the recovery program, he served as a legal advisor to the Congressional Oversight Panel for that program under the leadership of now Senator Elizabeth Warren. And he assisted that panel in its first report evaluating the investments made by the Treasury under the program. As a member of the Law Department, I'm pleased to report that Chairman Massad has a legal background. Before working for the government, he was a partner at the law firm Kravath, Swain & Moore, LLP. And in that role, he had a broad corporate practice. He focused on corporate finance and financial markets, and he helped to draft the original standardized agreement for swaps and helped many businesses negotiate and execute transactions to hedge exposures in the derivatives market. He earned his bachelor and his law degree at Harvard. He was born in New Orleans, and he also lived in Texas, Oklahoma, and Connecticut. He now lives in Washington with his wife, Charlotte, and with two children. Tonight's speech has the title, Financial Regulation Back to the Future. And we're going to hear about what is going to happen, or what should happen, or maybe shouldn't happen, to the regulation that was put in place after the financial crisis, and it was put in place with a view to putting stability into the system. And there have been two events that have collided with that reform effort, and that is in the UK, the Brexit decision, and in the United States, the presidential elections. And the big question that is sort of ahead of us is what is going to happen to the efforts that have been made after the financial crisis. Let me just give you some housekeeping information. Please switch off your phones or put them on silent. And for Twitter users, the hashtag for tonight's event is hashtag LSE Massad. And let me now welcome our speaker, and we look forward to your remarks.
Well, thank you, Eva, for that very warm introduction. I'm very pleased to be here. I join you tonight at a time of uncertainty, a time when the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe are entering uncharted political waters. In the United States, we are 10 days away from the inauguration of a new president, whose election defied all political predictions and conventions. And what Mr. Trump's presidency will mean for both domestic policy and the role of the United States in the world is difficult to predict. And here in Britain, the vote to exit the European Union will take the United Kingdom and Europe on a path that is not yet known to a new relationship that has not yet been defined. And so we find ourselves in a very different position than 8 years ago when President Obama was about to take office. In January of 2009, the world was in the depths of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Financial institutions across the globe were on the brink of collapse. In the United States alone, we were losing more than 750,000 jobs a month. Over time, nearly 9 million people lost their homes, lost their jobs. Over 5 million lost their homes. And $13 trillion in family wealth was destroyed. Many lives were shattered, and many opportunities were lost. Worldwide, the damage was similar. In the UK and the EU, unemployment reached record levels. And 25% of global gross domestic product was lost. It's been quite a transformation in the last 8 years. In the US, since 2010, we have added 15.5 million jobs. The unemployment rate has been halved, and home prices have recovered. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was less than 8,500 on January 12, 2009. Today, it is nearing 20,000. Now, this climb back from the brink of disaster was the result of massive government responses in the U.S., the U.K., the EU, and around the world. Governments and their central banks took unprecedented actions to stabilize their economies. And this was followed by actions to address the underlying causes of the crisis that were similarly unprecedented in their scope as well as in their degree of international coordination. But the presidential election in the U.S. and the Brexit vote here in the U.K. have been interpreted as evidence of deep discontent with governmental policies and economic conditions, particularly by working-class voters, as well as discontent with immigration. To many commentators, these votes call into question assumed wisdom about the benefits of international trade and globalization. In the United States, there is talk of repealing many of the reforms taken in response to the crisis, as they have been said to hinder economic growth. And here in the UK, the Brexit vote raises questions about the future of London as an international financial center. So what may lie ahead when it comes to regulation of our financial markets and institutions? I will not really make predictions, but rather offer some suggestions about the way forward. And that is, we should not reverse the reforms made since the crisis. I do not believe the discontent that may have driven recent elections would be remedied by dismantling these reforms. Reducing the risk of financial instability in the future contributes to economic security for all. But at the same time, we should be willing to consider ways to improve these reforms and recognize that addressing the causes of that discontent in full requires a broader response. Let's first go back to the crisis and how we climbed out of it. There were many causes of the crisis: a bubble in house and other asset prices, excessive risk taking by banks, mounting corporate and household debt, and a regulatory system that had gaps and deficiencies. The U.S. government launched an all-out effort to prevent the crisis from becoming a global depression. And initially, at least, this was a bipartisan effort. A key part of the response to the crisis in the U.S. was the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Through TARP, we provided capital to banks, not just big banks, but many, many small institutions. We implemented a housing program that helped millions of people stay in their homes. We took action to restart the frozen credit markets, and we prevented the U.S. auto industry from collapsing. The U.S. government took many other actions, including economic stimulus measures, and other governments, of course, took action as well. Central banks around the world used their monetary policy muscle to prevent a worldwide Great Depression. So it was a war fought on many fronts, and it succeeded. And as that fire was extinguished, we turned to addressing the causes of the crisis in order to prevent it from happening again. And this, too, has been a war fought on many fronts. It has included stronger capital requirements for banks, limits on leverage, reforms of the derivatives market, and the creation of tools to deal with failing financial institutions without using taxpayer funds. Now, this evening, I will focus on the derivatives reforms, not only because I've been most involved in that work, but also because it is the area where, in some ways, we have traveled the farthest. We have gone from a world in which there was essentially no regulation by any jurisdiction of certain activities to a remarkable level of international cooperation in the implementation of a sensible common framework. The derivatives markets are comprised of futures, options, and swaps, and most people do not participate in these markets directly. And yet, they profoundly affect the prices we all pay for food, energy, and many other goods and services. If you are a farmer, you want to know what price you will get for your crop in the fall in order to decide how much to plant in the spring. The derivatives markets allow you to lock in that price in advance. You may give up some upside, but you protect yourself on the downside. These markets enable utility companies and airlines to hedge the cost of fuel. An auto manufacturer can fix the cost of its aluminum supply. Exporters can manage fluctuations in foreign currencies. And businesses of all types can lock in their borrowing costs. A pension fund that wants to make sure it can pay benefits over a very long horizon can use these markets to help lock in its ability to do so. So in the simplest terms, derivatives markets help businesses throughout the world, up and down the economic value chain, manage price volatility. In short, derivatives help manage risk. And while most of the derivatives markets worked well during the crisis, one large and unregulated segment intensified the damage. And this was the over-the-counter swaps market, and in particular, credit default swaps. At the time of the crisis, this swaps market was a tangled spider web of bilateral transactions, particularly among the world's largest financial institutions, with no transparency and nothing to ensure adequate capital or collateral. Therefore, a default by one institution could easily lead to a cascade of defaults and devastating consequences. And this scenario brought global financial companies such as AIG to the brink of collapse. And had AIG collapsed, it would probably have taken the U.S. economy down with it. Therefore, our government committed a total of $182 billion over the course of several months to prevent that from happening. Now, that's an unfathomable sum. And though we recovered all those AIG funds with a profit, that commitment rightly caused public outrage. So in 2009 in Pittsburgh, President Obama, then Prime Minister Brown, and the other leaders of the G20 nations agreed to make a number of reforms to the over-the-counter swaps market. They agreed that standardized swaps would be cleared through central clearinghouses, which is a means to mitigate and monitor the risk. They agreed that there should be capital and margin or collateral for uncleared contracts, again, to reduce the risk. They agreed that standardized swaps should be traded on regulated platforms and that all contracts would be reported to trade repositories in order to bring transparency and greater integrity to the market. In the United States, these derivative measures and many other reforms were codified in sweeping legislation entitled the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, commonly known as Dodd-Frank. My agency was given the primary responsibility for implementing the swaps reforms, and we have put that regulatory framework in place. We now require collateral and capital to stand behind swap transactions. We have mandated central clearing for most swaps, and we require that trading take place on regulated platforms. Swap dealers must abide by basic oversight requirements, and we have increased transparency through regular reporting. And over the last several years, regulators from around the world, including in particular the UK and the EU, have also been implementing these measures. And these measures are working. For example, over 80% of swap transactions are being cleared today, as compared to only about 15% in 2007. And margin is being posted and collected for uncleared swaps. A significant focus of my efforts when I became chairman has been to increase international coordination and harmonization of these reforms. The lack of harmonization was a major criticism, and we have made tremendous progress here as well. For example, we've harmonized collateral requirements, also referred to as bilateral margin, for uncleared swaps worldwide. We are coordinating clearing requirements. Last year, the U.S. and the EU reached a landmark agreement that resolved critical issues regarding the supervision and recognition of clearinghouses. And this agreement brought our regulatory regimes closer together. And there are many other joint international efforts taking place today with regard to clearinghouse resilience, standards for data reporting, and a number of other areas. Now, the derivatives reforms were just one part of the global efforts to strengthen the financial system in the wake of the crisis. The G20 leaders agreed to many other actions. These included establishing the Financial Stability Board, or FSB, with a mandate to promote financial stability and assess vulnerabilities in the global financial system. Regulators from around the world have strengthened the capital and liquidity standards for banks. Common equity levels are 10 times higher than pre-crisis. Leverage is much lower, and reliance on short-term funding has declined. So-called shadow banking is being addressed. And there has also been substantial work done to give governments the tools to resolve or shut down failing institutions without taxpayer funds, so that we create a system in which a major institution can fail without causing a broader systemic problem. Now, in all these areas, there is still work to do. And there are sometimes disagreements over the best path, even among those who support the basic objectives. But I believe we are in a much better place today than 8 years ago. So what effect will recent political events have on the regulation of financial markets? Will we see an abrupt halt or a reversal in the actions taken to reform the global financial system? And what about the prospects for continued international cooperation in these matters? If, in fact, these recent political events signal opposition to certain aspects of globalization, in particular to the free movement of people and goods across borders, are we entering a period when nations will be so focused on domestic priorities that we should expect less international cooperation when it comes to regulation of the financial system? And will competing nations end up racing toward lower regulatory standards in order to attract capital or business? Well, it's too early to know or even reasonably predict what exactly will happen. But I want to offer a few observations and suggestions for what I believe is the proper way forward, particularly as it applies to derivatives, the area under our jurisdiction. My belief is that to repeal or dismantle the reforms we have implemented would be a major mistake. They have made the system more resilient, and that contributes to a stronger economy. Their repeal would not contribute to improving the economic conditions that might have given rise to populist discontent expressed in these recent votes. But at the same time, these reforms are not perfect. They surely can be improved upon. And more importantly, the goal of building economies that create opportunity for all requires more than just preventing financial instability. On that score, we have more to do. I want to focus first on whether we will see less international cooperation in implementing reforms. And as I say, I certainly hope not, because I believe it is actually necessary to address the concerns about economic opportunity and growth that may have been expressed in these recent votes. Now, let me explain that, because it might sound like a contradiction. Earlier, I noted that when I took office, there were many complaints about the lack of harmonization of these derivatives reforms across international borders. And when I would hear this, I would point out that, well, actually, there are very few areas of financial regulation that are harmonized across national boundaries. Consider securities laws. If a company wants to make a public offering of its securities, compliance with U.S. law does not entitle it to do a public offering here in the U.K. or in most other countries. It must instead comply with local laws in each jurisdiction. And there are significant differences in national regulatory regimes when it comes to secured lending, corporate tax policy, or just about any other area of financial regulation you might name. So I believe that many in the derivatives industry who would make these complaints presumed that there should be harmonization because they were used to a world in which there was no regulation before the crisis. Global banks were able to transact swaps across borders without worrying about differences in rules because there were essentially no rules to worry about. But that's in part what led to the very problems we faced in the financial crisis. AIG built up its excessive risk through an operation here in London, into which U.S. regulators had no visibility. And the crisis spread from its origins in the U.S. mortgage industry, in part because investors around the world purchased mortgage-backed securities and derivatives that were not regulated in the U.S. or in their home countries. So, in short, the global nature of the financial system had outstripped the ability of national regulators to oversee it. And this was true not just in derivatives. It was true in other areas as well. There is a global market for finance. Capital moves in a microsecond from one jurisdiction to another, and with it, the investment that can create jobs. But we still regulate the system through nation states. There is no global regulator. So what we have been doing since the crisis is trying to catch up, working as individual nations to plug the regulatory holes and deficiencies that contributed to the crisis, and to do it in a coordinated way so that we have effective regulation of the global financial system. So if we enter a period when there is less international cooperation in regulating the global financial system, or worse, regulatory competition, that is likely to increase the risk of financial instability, which can in turn lead to another crisis that causes the type of suffering we saw last time. Clearly, though, these recent political events may lead to some changes in the current regulatory framework. So let me offer first a few observations on possible implications of Brexit. And this is, of course, from the point of view of an American financial regulator. First, whatever the terms of the future relationship between the UK and Europe, I hope it does not reduce the commitment to these financial market reforms generally and does not lead to this type of competition to attract business that lowers standards. And to date, there's been a deep commitment to these reforms here in London as well as in other European capitals. It's been reported that the UK plans to repeal the European Union financial regulation rules but then adopt equivalent measures as UK law. And such a path would mean that the UK would continue to have laws and regulations equivalent to those in the EU. But there may still be challenges. And one area where I see challenges for both sides is with respect to the regulation of clearinghouses and potentially other core market infrastructure such as exchanges or trading platforms. Now, While this may seem somewhat technical, it could affect London's role as the preeminent financial center in Europe. So let me explain it further. Once the UK is no longer part of the European Union, European law today would require the EU to determine that the UK has an equivalent regulatory regime for its clearinghouses and trading platforms. This is the same equivalence process that every other non-EU country must go through and that the US went through. Failure to be found equivalent would mean European financial firms will face higher capital charges for transactions cleared in the UK. But under current law, the process for deciding whether to grant equivalence would not start until after the UK exits, that is, once the UK becomes a third country. As a result, there would need to be a change in the process to avoid a gap between exit and recognition. And so negotiators will be faced with whether they can agree to a process or relationship for the post-Brexit world during the actual exit negotiations. Second is whether Europe is willing to apply the same equivalence framework to the UK as it did with other countries. Now, when the CFTC was in negotiations with the EU over clearinghouse equivalence, and this took a long time, I felt the EU applied somewhat tougher conditions to us than what were being applied to other countries. This reflected the relative importance of the US market to Europe. The London market, of course, is even more important to the EU. So it would not surprise me if the UK faced a similar situation. Further, Europe may want greater ongoing oversight of UK clearinghouses and trading platforms, given their importance to the European economy. The equivalence standard is largely a one-time decision, and therefore it does not provide this type of ongoing oversight. This, too, could lead to changes in the process. Moreover, there have been calls by European leaders to move the clearing of euro-denominated products from London to continental Europe. This would provide European central banks and regulators greater oversight for that activity, particularly as it relates to monetary policy. However, it would limit the efficiencies that investors otherwise obtain by managing their euro-denominated transactions with the rest of their portfolios. And that could raise costs for businesses transacting in such products, and it could affect the location decisions of some financial services firms. Now, many of you may know that the UK successfully brought a legal challenge against the European Central Bank regarding this issue before the Brexit vote. The ECB tried to insist that certain clearing move to Europe. But the issue has resurfaced following Brexit. So if Europe insists that clearing of euro-denominated products cannot occur in London, that could also give rise to questions as to whether such clearing can occur anywhere outside of Europe, including in the United States. And that, in turn, could lead to other countries considering whether to adopt similar policies regarding clearing of products in their own currencies. Now, the volume of euro-denominated products cleared in the U.S. is pretty small. The volume of dollar-denominated derivatives, however, that are cleared in London is very large. And indeed, there is more dollar swaps clearing in London than euro swaps clearing. So for our part, the CFTC has never insisted that dollar-denominated products be cleared in the US. So we have a different approach than equivalence. We require overseas clearinghouses that do substantial US business to register with us and provide us with access just like any US-based clearinghouse. And so that framework gives us the ability to oversee what is going on at such foreign clearinghouses. And we have today, and we've had for several years, oversight of major London clearinghouses as a result. There are also pending private sector transactions that may affect these issues, most notably the proposed merger of the London Stock Exchange with the Deutsche Börse. So how does one balance these concerns? The desire to have oversight of important activity that is offshore, but also to preserve the efficiencies that may exist when clearing of multiple products is concentrated in one place. Could some sort of enhanced ability of European regulators to oversee activity that is offshore satisfy the call to relocate the clearing of euro-denominated products? Now, these, I know, are just a couple of the many, many challenging issues created by Brexit. And let me just say, the UK and the EU are very important partners and allies for us in the US. And this obviously transcends issues of financial regulation. And so I hope the parties can negotiate the exit, the transition, and the future relationship in a way that leads to a good result for all. And I hope our government can offer support toward that end. Let me turn to the United States election. I noted that there have been calls to repeal or dismantle Dodd-Frank. Now, the law covers a wide variety of subjects. The derivatives reforms are just one of 12 chapters. And there are many different views, even within the Republican Party and the financial sector, on what exactly to do. For example, some who say they don't like Dodd-Frank have called for raising capital and leverage requirements on banks in return for simplifying certain regulation. There have been calls to eliminate or ease the restrictions of the Volcker Rule, which restricts trading by banks, but at the same time, calls by some for reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act, which requires a separation between commercial and investment banking being where that trading activity resides. Some have called for reform of Dodd-Frank rather than repeal. They've focused on particular provisions, such as whether the law unfairly burdens smaller banks. So, in my view, it is unclear what will happen. I believe the wholesale repeal of Dodd-Frank would be a big mistake. And in particularly when it comes to the reforms of the swaps market, there's actually a wide consensus that the reforms made sense. Now, that does not mean there are not good faith differences about how to implement this framework, nor does it mean we cannot improve upon the existing rules. We surely can. And I and my fellow commissioners at the CFTC took office after many of the rules had been issued, and we worked hard to fine-tune and improve them. We worked to make sure the rules were focused on the areas of greatest risk and did not create unintended consequences. We worked to strengthen relationships with international regulators and harmonize regulations across borders. And we did much of this work on a bipartisan, unanimous basis. And there is more that can be done to improve the rules. So I would hope that we continue to improve them and not repeal them. And that should involve continuing to analyze the impact of these reforms and the conditions of our markets. Nowhere is it more important to look at the consequences of these derivatives reforms than with central clearing. As I said earlier, we mandated the increased use of these central clearinghouses for swaps. But because we've done so, some have raised concerns that have we simply created new systemic points of failure? So we must make sure clearinghouses themselves are strong and resilient. Now, I think the model is a sound one, and my agency has been doing a great deal both domestically and with other international regulators to look at this and to make sure clearinghouses are resilient. Recently, for example, our staff published a report on a series of supervisory stress tests that we performed on the five largest clearinghouses under our jurisdiction. Now, these are not just located in the U.S. Some are located here in London. And We have the ability to do that because of the oversight I described earlier that cuts across national borders. The results were very positive. I won't go into the details here. Happy to talk about them if you want in the question session. But this was a good first study, and we need to continue this type of work. Another area that has been and should continue to get attention and is market liquidity. And there's been a lot of discussion about this and about whether the various reforms we have made, particularly those outside of the derivatives space, to enhance the capital of our largest banks and to limit certain activities, whether those have adversely affected market liquidity. This is worth examining. But in doing so, let's remember that liquidity may have been underpriced before the crisis, and the reforms were meant to correct that. And in addition, liquidity is shaped by many factors, not just regulation, shaped by market structure, technological change, and general economic conditions. And it can be very hard to separate the effects of these various factors. Now, in particular, over the last several years, the nature of liquidity has changed as a result of the vastly increased amount of automated trading in our markets. Both the composition of who trades and the way that firms trade has changed enormously. And as regulators, we are behind the curve in terms of understanding all the implications of automated trading. We've been making this a priority at the CFTC, and more needs to be done around the world to make sure that our markets still function with integrity and serve the businesses that need them. So these examples, clearinghouse resilience, market liquidity and its relationship to automated trading, remind us that markets evolve constantly. They change in response to regulation, but also, and perhaps more importantly, they evolve as a result of technological advances, macroeconomic conditions, and other factors. So as regulators, we must make sure we are not just looking backwards, addressing the causes of past problems, such as the financial crisis, as important as that is. We must be looking forward as well. There is no greater example of that proposition today than the need to focus on the risk of cyber attack. Cyber threats are probably the greatest single threat to financial stability today. And this has been a priority of mine, and I hope it will continue to be so for the CFTC. And I hope that any debate over the reforms we have already made does not distract us from facing the new challenges and opportunities ahead. Let me conclude with this. We are unlikely to predict what will cause the next financial crisis, and there will be further ones. But the measures we have implemented in response to the 2008 financial crisis have made the global financial system more resilient, and the international cooperation in their implementation has been unprecedented. We are responding to the fact that the global financial system had outstripped the ability of national regulators to oversee it. And all of this work helps reduce the likelihood of a repetition of the terrible economic damage and suffering that we experienced just a few years ago. Suffering, which surely contributed to the discontent we have witnessed at the polls. But that discontent also reflects other forces. In particular, in my view, the broader challenges facing our economies as a result of structural shifts due to decades of globalization and automation. And addressing those issues requires additional, potentially much broader responses. Now, whether that involves job retraining, infrastructure funding, tax reform, or other policy changes is beyond the scope of my remarks tonight. But I think regardless of how you voted in the American election or in the Brexit referendum, those economic concerns deserve to be fully addressed. So I hope our political systems and leaders can meet that challenge while maintaining reasonable regulation of the global financial marketplace. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Brexit are going to face, and it strikes me once again this won't be an easy task. I will now open the floor for questions, and I think the best way of doing it is to take perhaps two or three questions at a time.
Whatever. I don't know if I can keep track, but maybe we'll just do. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
And if you can, could you perhaps mention your name and your affiliation?
Good evening, Chairman Mossad. My name is Werner Kranenburg, and I'm an attorney. The question I have is a very simple one. You mentioned an upcoming inauguration. Will you be staying on?
And if so, no, I've announced my resignation already. And as chairman, I serve at the pleasure of the president. It is basically common. It is the tradition when the party when the control of the White House changes party for a person in my position to step down. Yeah, there's whatever.
Thank you. Peter Danzig, retired. You mentioned that you hope that they will improve rather than repeal the regulations. And given the background of Trump's cabinet, the member of the cabinet, how hopeful are you that that will happen?
I think it really is unclear. You have people, for example, his National Economic Council head is someone who is quite familiar with these regulations and gave a speech before he was named as such who said, don't expect a repeal. Banks have already adapted to a lot of these things, and a lot of them have made the system stronger. Now, again, he would point out things he doesn't like, I'm sure. Again, Dodd-Frank covers a lot of different things. I mean, some of it, for example, is the resolution authority as to how we deal with failing institutions. If you get rid of that, what are you going to do? You're going to pass another TARP program? No one wants to do that. And one of the leaders in Congress who has called for repeal, as I say, has really come at it from the perspective of the regulation should be less prescriptive, but we should increase capital requirements, even above where they are today. Well, that's, so there's just a wide range of views. So I think we have to wait and see. Yeah. Yeah, let's get the mic for you.
Bernard Casey from London School of Economics. I wanted to ask about evolutions. I wanted to ask about shadow banks, and
yeah.
I wanted to ask about the FSB, because the FSB has excluded from its definition of shadow banks pension funds. And I'm interested in the role of large defined contribution pension funds, which are supposedly very liquid for the members. They were supposed to be able to trade in and out of what they have. And yet at the same time, these pension funds are the things which are being looked for in the place of banks to provide for long-term finance, particularly in this interesting area of infrastructure. I wondered whether you could comment upon the extent of instability which is actually being built in by a result of this transformation and this evolution.
Well, the area of asset management is not under our jurisdiction. I am familiar with these issues as a member of our Financial Stability Oversight Council. But, you know, let me just talk generally about what our approach has been in the U.S., and this has really been carried out by the SEC. The focus in the SEC has been to look at what we call a potential maturity mismatch, where you have long-term obligations but short-term funding, and to adopt measures that address that. Money market reforms, you may have heard about these, where we've also required, the SEC has required that if the assets of the fund fall, if the what we would call, say, the liquid assets fall below a certain level, then you have to take certain actions to prevent a run on the fund. So that's the approach. In the U.S., we've not gone down the path of designating, you know, asset management firms as systemically important, but rather looked upon it as an activity where we, again, need to address this this mismatch issue. I'll leave it to the FSB to speak for themselves, though, on their views. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for the very interesting lecture.
Yeah.
My name is Katarzyna Szwarc. I work in the energy sector, and I wanted to ask about commodity derivatives.
Yeah. Commodity swaps, did you say?
Commodity derivatives in general, especially with respect to position limits.
Yeah.
So following the financial crisis, the U.S. has introduced legislation that allowed the CFTC to impose position limits
right.
on certain commodity derivatives. As far as I remember, these were 28 contracts on top of the agricultural derivatives that already had position limits. The EU has taken a slightly different approach, imposing position limits on each and every single commodity derivative being traded in the EU. I was wondering what your opinion
sure. so
was
on
this.
So just to maybe explain the background here. So position limits refer to limits on the ability of traders as to the number of, say, futures or swaps contracts in a particular commodity they can hold, particularly as those futures and swaps contracts reach what we call the point of expiration. And so why do you need that? Well, you want to make sure that the derivatives contracts aren't used to sort of manipulate the price of the underlying real commodity. So, for example, could you buy up a lot of natural gas futures in order to affect the underlying price of natural gas? Position limits are intended to prevent that sort of activity. And as your question stated, we've had position limits in the U.S. mandated by the CFTC in agricultural contracts, 9 agricultural contracts for decades. The Congress in Dodd-Frank directed us to develop them for other contracts. Today, what we have are what we call exchange-based limits. In other words, it's not federally mandated, but the exchanges themselves impose those limits. So we have been working on this rule, and I had hoped to finalize it, but we decided instead in December to repropose our rule to give people further chance to comment on it because we had made a number of changes. The EU has taken a broader approach. We were looking at as you say, a total of about 28 contracts, and actually in our most recent proposal, I think we're down to 25. But those are the principal physical commodity contracts, meaning not just agriculture, but oil, natural gas, certain metals. The EU, I think, intends to cover quite a few more, potentially thousands. So that's, you know, it's a big undertaking. So, you know, I hope that we can still implement this rule, that the CFTC does go forward with this. Though, you know, I would just point out that today we do have the limits in place for agricultural commodities, and we do have the exchange limits for the others. I'll be interested to see how the European scheme works out. Yeah, sure. That's right here.
My name is Robert Heath. I retired but used to work in Washington at the IMF. I was interested in, you talked about international cooperation. I wondered about domestic cooperation within the US. Rather fragmented regulatory system. Obviously, the Financial Stability Oversight Committee was created, and I wondered how you found that was operating.
Well, I think it's very useful toward that end. We have the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which brings together all the financial regulators. You know, we do have different regulators for different areas. That's because of historical evolution as well as specialization. My view has always been that whether you design the boxes so that there are a series of different boxes or whether you put it all together, there's pros and cons both ways. But what is important is trying to coordinate. And the FSOC has helped that, and I've made it a priority to do that. And a lot of it does depend on who the people are in office. And I think we should, you know, hopefully we will have people chairing these agencies in the future who will put a value on coordination. There's always more that you could probably do, but I think we've made good progress there. I mean, to give you an example on margin rules for uncleared swaps, which I consider probably the most important single rule, even that rule is not just done by us, it's also done by the bank regulators, but we managed to harmonize our rules so there's very few differences. All right, let's maybe go up here, and then we should get over to the other side of the room here. We'll go there, and then over to you.
Hello, I'm Herman Smith from the Center for Financial Regulation and Inclusion, based in South Africa. You stopped short from proclaiming it, but potentially different scenarios for the relative participation of the US and the UK in the G20 and the role that the G20
might... I stopped short of what?
Talking about... So you spoke about the FSB and the G20 collaboration, but just how Brexit and Trump can potentially change the role that the US and the UK play in the G20 processes.
You know, again, I mean, I think we have to give the president-elect some time here. You know, he's just now assembling his team. He's obviously has a different style than our current president. You know, I think we just have to wait and see how this plays out. It's very hard to say right now. Yeah, go up those two and then over to the other side.
Hi there. I'm Laura. I work in compliance for futures and clearing at a large bank that you find during your time.
You can tell
me
how
time.
Well these rules are working.
Yep. I think one of the things that I, in particular, note covering futures traders on a day-to-day is that the historic level of regulation on those exchanges and the level of oversight means that the way they behave and the consideration that they give to client outcomes and market conduct and transparency is incredibly different than perhaps how traders might behave in, let's say, the corporate bond market or something like that. And really, it makes my job a heck of a lot easier in the sense that, you know, the rules permeate eventually into the culture that is embedded in those traders.
Right.
And what do you think, I think I'm on, to be honest, when I look at how well-designed I think a futures market is.
Yeah.
And I look at the corporate bond market and other markets like it, I think it's astounding that in 2017 they're still so different. What do you think it would take to get some of these more opaque markets to reach a more, I guess, modern... Yep.
Well, yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. No, it's a very, very good question. I mean, you know, the corporate bond market is also not under our jurisdiction, though... You know, we have been involved in work that's gone on regarding our treasury market because, you know, we had an incident a couple of years ago where there was extreme volatility in the U.S. treasury market that lasted about 10 minutes, and no one could really figure out why. Treasury prices, you know, went up and then went right back down. And, you know, a lot of people immediately said, oh, it's because of regulation, you know, that's what's caused this. So, you know, the SEC, the CFTC, the Federal Reserve, the New York Fed, the Treasury Department all got together and we did an extensive study and we got all the trading records. We looked at trading at the microsecond level and tried to look at, you know, what exactly happened here. And there was no particular cause. We didn't really see any evidence that this was due to regulation. What we did see was, again, as I referred earlier, the nature of trading has changed quite a bit in terms of automated trading being the dominant force. And that, I think, can sometimes create these volatile moments that don't otherwise have explanation. I've kind of gone off a bit on your question. In terms of the bond market, I guess where I was going is, you know, there are now efforts with respect to the Treasury market to bring greater transparency to it. And so that's an example, I think, of where you were going. That will largely be with the SEC and with FINRA, but they are working on that. It's an extremely important market. No one wants to mess it up. But, you know, if we can bring a little bit greater transparency and maybe minimize the risk of this type of activity, that would be a good thing. Your question, though, is a good one because it reminds us that all these markets are different. I mean, they have similarities, but the corporate bond market is very different than the futures market. Both those markets are very different than the equities market. And, you know, particularly when people sort of talk about the effects of regulation or liquidity or so forth, you gotta really say, well, you know, which market are you talking about? And, you know, let's look at what the market structure is there and who's trading and is it a retail market or is it a, you know, is it a sophisticated participant market like the swap market? And you have to kind of define all those things before you can really talk about what the appropriate level of regulation is. The bond market, you know, has been a dealer-driven market. Obviously, we've adopted some measures which have constrained the activities of traditional dealers, but, you know, other participants have stepped in. I mean, for example, again, coming back to our own markets, which I know best, people said, well, you know, the problem when this Treasury securities problem happened and the same thing happened in Treasury futures, people said, well, that's because, you know, the banks are no longer as present in this market. If they had been more active with their balance sheets, you know, they would have minimized this volatility. And we kind of pointed out they really haven't been that active for a while in these markets. These markets have already changed. So I guess I would just answer your question by saying, you know, you got to look at it market by market. I think there is some work going on in the Treasury market that may lead to more work on the corporate bond market. But, you know, they're important questions. We should be willing to do it. So let's maybe, yeah.
My name is Issam Samir. I'm from Birkbeck College at University of London. I want to first thank you for the lecture. It was very interesting to hear your opinions on these issues. And I wanted to ask regarding the more standardization and of the swap contracts. As these things are becoming more standard, more transparent, traded on central clearinghouses, How do you look on the possibility of an emergence of automatic trading on these swaps, especially credit default swaps and equivalents? And what's your view of this? What are the potential risks and how you would assess these risks? And also a second question very quickly is, does the CFTC consider extending these efforts to more things like correlation products, in particular CDOs, swaps, like CDOs in a synthetic format traded through swaps? Thank you.
Well, in terms of automated trading for swaps, you know, we are mandating that certain swaps be traded on regulated platforms, what we call swap execution facilities, or on exchanges. So I think you will start to see greater automated trading, certainly electronic trading. We're seeing that now. It will take time. You know, the futures market, all futures in our country are traded on exchanges. And we have typically a centralized exchange, meaning just the way that the markets have evolved and the way liquidity evolves, you will typically have one exchange that, you know, say may trade the dominant contract in a particular commodity. And there was what we call a centralized limit order book. So all orders come into the same book. As you start to go to electronic markets and you get electronic centralized limit order books, so in other words, you have a centralized market, all bids and offers are coming into one order book that everybody can see, it's electronic, that's going to lead, and it did lead, to automated trading. Just kind of a natural thing. If you have a market where, you know, people are calling each other up on the phone, as a lot of some of the OTC swaps and sometimes the bond market, you know, takes longer for that to happen. But, you know, I think we will see more automated trading in it, and it's important that we be ready for that and ready in terms of being able to oversee that. On the extension, I mean, it depends if the product is under our jurisdiction. You know, some of the, I think, you know, CDOs, we haven't, I'm not even sure we have jurisdiction over a CDO, but it's kind of, you know, that's not a standardized, you know, product that we're mandating at this point. So let's go over here and just, yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Eilish Farrell. I'm the University of Cambridge.
Yeah.
Can I take you back to your discussion about equivalence?
Sure,
In the context of the UK's discussions. Yeah. There's been a lot of discussion about equivalence in the UK as whether that could be a basis for the UK to continue to have participate in e-markets, with a lot of scepticism about equivalence as a basis for that trade, for a number of reasons, including the argument that equivalence is very fragile and it could be withdrawn at any time, and also that although it is a technical process, there is the political overlay to that, and that this would be very sort of unstable and risky for the UK. I wonder, from your perspective, of the years it took to get the equivalence determination between the EU and the US, whether you could maybe reflect a bit on that, and whether those who are very pessimistic about equivalence perhaps could take some reassurance from the eventual outcome?
Well, I mean, look, it took a long time for us to negotiate our equivalence deal, I think, for a number of reasons that I don't think necessarily go to the basic design of the equivalence framework. The background in our case, and kind of the situation that I inherited when I took office, was that basically the CFTC had promulgated a lot of its swaps reforms before other countries had done so. So even though the G20 all agreed at the same time, the U.S. went faster. Now, why? Well, primarily because the Congress mandated that the CFTC implement these reforms within a year. And so the agency worked very hard to do that. But as a result, people in Europe, elsewhere, said, well, wait a minute. You know, we're not sure we're going to do it exactly the way you're going to do it, and shouldn't we have agreed as to how we're going to do this? And so there were and that's kind of what gave rise to the whole lack of harmonization and a lot of the criticism. And that became somewhat contentious, and on top of that, the way our rules worked was, well, we'll grant what we call substitute compliance. If another jurisdiction has similar rules to ours, we'll say you can comply with those rules. But if the jurisdiction hasn't even adopted any rules, we can't do that, right? And so that meant that our rules were reaching offshore to regulate activity offshore. So that whole situation, I think, created a lot of tension in the relationship. And I took office, and then a few months after I took office, Lord Jonathan Hill, became the EU commissioner. And so, you know, we then had to kind of work with that overhang. And I think that plus just the importance of clearinghouses and the honest differences in how we went about regulating them. And there were honest differences, different approaches. Took a long time. I guess when you say, well, equivalence is potentially fragile, I guess, well, what are we saying is the alternative? I mean, that is the EU framework today. And as I say, as I said, you know, what I would wonder about is, as they look at London and figure out how to apply that framework, might they want to make some changes to it? As to, you know, the absence of permanence, I mean, look, we can withdraw, you know, if we felt a clearinghouse suddenly wasn't complying by our rules or doing something, we could take action, we could withdraw that recognition. So I don't know that, you know, I mean, I guess the point is there always has to be kind of some ongoing engagement and communication and coordination and hopefully build up of trust so that that doesn't happen. Yeah, I don't know. Let's go higher up, I guess. There's a question up there. We'll try to get to everybody if we can. Yeah.
Hi, good evening. I'm Adil Siddiqui from Unbroker Dealer. Yeah. So the FCA plans to impose leverage restrictions on CFDs, something you've had for a while.
I'm sorry, leverage restrictions on?
On CFDs, contract for difference, so the spot FX, financial spread bets.
Okay.
So you've had this in the US for a while. What's your view on that? And then do you think under Dodd-Frank this will be repealed?
I've got to check with my staff on that. Sorry. You've gotten too technical for me tonight. I can get back to you. You got a more general question? Here, who's next? Let's just shout your question.
Kevin James with the Financial Conduct Authority.
Yeah.
So you've been running the CFTC during a very interesting time in financial regulation.
Yes.
I've
learned a lot.
What would you say going forward? How would you reform financial regulation to make it more effective?
Oh, boy. Get us a bigger budget would be the main thing. What we do, you know, requires resources, and we've been sorely strained. I don't know that I can encapsulate it. Look, it's been, you know, it's been a great experience, and I feel I have learned a lot. I think that I could tell you kind of some of the things I did that I feel were particularly valuable in terms of what we achieved, and that was listening, talking to a lot of people, but more importantly, listening to a lot of people about what was going on in the markets, whether they were commercial participants, people who operated exchanges, people who operated clearinghouses, other regulators. You know, I think as regulators, we should approach our jobs with a degree of humility about what we're entrusted to do and what we can do, because, you know, financial markets evolve so quickly, and it is difficult sometimes to write rules that are really going to work the way you think they should work. But, you know, trying to get as much input as you can and listening to the concerns of people is extremely important. I had a very open door. I took, you know, most companies who wanted a meeting with me to talk about what they felt wasn't working or was working, I mean, I took the meeting. I felt that was my job, you know. I work for the American people, so if a business wants to come in and tell me, you know, we don't like what you're doing here, I tried to take the meeting and listen. So I have to reflect more. I have to get away from it a little bit, maybe to reflect more fully on other lessons I've learned, but that would be a couple. Yeah, sure. Down here and here. Oh, we'll get over there too.
Hi, thanks for the talk. Nathan Berg, I'm a student here at LSE.
Yeah.
One of the main complaints that I've heard of Dodd-Frank is that it puts too much burden on small and community banks. Mm-hmm. Do you think that criticism is valid? And if it is, what steps would you recommend for them to lighten that burden?
You know, look, I'm not a bank regulator. So I am going to leave the details of that to them. But you are correct that a lot of people have said that. I can tell you that in our area, we've tried to focus on that issue. And we've done a few things to address the concerns of smaller banks who aren't the big players in the swaps market. And I felt, you know, there were areas where they shouldn't really be the focus of some of these rules. We provided certain exemptions to them. Another issue we have is really who is a swap dealer? How much activity makes you a swap dealer? And we have a threshold that was supposed to automatically fall, which would have picked up a lot more banks and a lot of smaller banks, but their total activity wasn't that significant in the whole market, right? So in other words, we were already, through the big guys that are already subject to registration, we were already covering most of the market. And had we let that threshold fall, we would have made a lot of people comply with the rules, but from a systemic risk standpoint, might not add that much. So we decided to not let it fall. We're going to look at it further. That'll be for the next commission. So, you know, I think as a general proposition, I would say that we want in the U.S. to have a strong, thriving small bank community. We do today. We have a lot of small banks relative to most countries. If you look at the composition of the banking industry, we have a lot of small banks. But I think it's, you know, it's worth looking at whether certain rules are unfairly burdening them. Let's go over here.
Hello. My name is Alex McCazin. I'm working as an architect in London.
I'm sorry, can you speak up? I have trouble hearing you.
I work as an architect, but I've just got some layman questions. You briefly touched on the idea of making more centralized clearinghouses for a lot of trading. And there being a possibility that as you aggregate all the risk into these central houses, there's a difficulty in coming up with a certain amount of margin for these trades if something goes wrong. With the discussion of the opaque areas of the market, like the corporate bond market and potentially off-balance sheet equity and debt instruments in areas such as Panama, how do you...
Areas such as what?
Panama. Or areas which are harder to view, shall we say, dark pools, etc. How do you approach regulating a market when there's so much information that you don't have to your fingertips?
I'm not quite sure I'm grasping the question. I've lost you a little bit.
Sorry. My question is, if there's a lot of equity and debt which a particular bank has on their balance sheet, which you can't view, how do you approach regulating a market?
Well, I mean, for our markets, we actually have quite a bit of insight. You know, for the clearinghouses, for example, so first of all, in a clearinghouse, you know, you're clearing these positions. You have what we call a flat book, meaning if someone is long a contract, there's somebody else who's short the contract because you're in the middle. There are clearing members, which are large financial institutions that are kind of the main participants in the market. So we get daily information about all of those positions. We can look at the clearinghouse. We can look at the clearing members. We can look even further down to the customers. We get daily information from the exchanges on trades, and we can get that down to the microsecond in terms of the trades that happen. We require large traders in our markets to file position reports. We get a huge amount of data, actually. So, you know, I think in the markets we regulate, we have quite a bit of insight. And that's, I think, necessary today to do a good job. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go up here, and then we'll go to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully a quick question. It's Eric Meyer. I work for a fund manager. A lot of regulation in the equity space has been focused on breaking the monopoly of exchanges and encouraging competition there. And in the futures market, I suppose, because as you already said, where liquidity is and the products are not fungible is kind of where the trading stays. So the CME, ICE, the big players, there isn't really any competition in any of the liquid products. Has that been considered, or is that a concern?
Well, I mean, I think you got to remember the nature of the products are different, right? I mean, on the and first of all, I'm not sure I would say that the purpose of the SEC reforms was to break the monopoly. I think technology changed how people trade, and the SEC had rules that permitted new exchanges to develop. But a stock exchange is trading shares of companies, right? The company issues those shares. So if I'm IBM and I issue my shares, someone wants to go trade them on the New York Stock Exchange, but someone else says, you know what, I want to go to this new online exchange that's been created because I think I'll get a better price. Well, basically the SEC has rules that, I'm speaking obviously very broadly, but that allow that multi-platform, if you will, kind of situation to arise. With futures contracts, it's different because a futures contract, there is an exchange which says, let's design a contract for people to hedge the price of oil. And here are the terms of the contract we want to offer. So it's the exchange itself which is essentially offering that contract. So, it's not a company that's offering a contract, which is then, could be traded in different places. So an exchange offers, say, a contract to hedge the price of oil. There could be another exchange which says, well, we want to do one too. And they can, and they have. And in the case of oil, we do have multiple contracts. We have one based on WTI and one based on Brent. But, in other products, it may be hard to do that because liquidity in these products naturally likes to come together, right? People who trade these products want big liquid pools. They like it when the liquidity is concentrated, meaning everybody is at the same place, right? Because then the market's deeper, there's more transactions, you get better pricing, and so forth. So, as they say, liquidity begets liquidity, which begets liquidity. It has that tendency. But there's nothing legally preventing someone from introducing a new contract and trying to challenge that. Yeah.
Paul McGrail, Catholic Workers Group. As someone who worked with Senator Warren, could you give a précis as to what her and perhaps Senator Sanders' criticism would be about the entire derivatives market, the futures market, in as much as it's the size of the daily, the volume and the complexity, do they feel that it's not serving any, as Lord Adair said here, any social purpose?
Well, you should ask them. I guess I would say I think there are people who would take the view, who are skeptical of the social utility of these contracts, who would say, isn't this just kind of sophisticated form of gambling that got our economy into trouble? There are certainly speculators in these markets. They need speculators in order to work. And obviously, there can be financial innovation that gets out of hand and that creates products that people don't understand. And I think that's what we saw in the crisis, right? We saw innovation that led to the creation of derivatives products that people were buying without really knowing what they were buying. And so they couldn't assess the risk, CDO squared and all that kind of stuff, right? I think it's important from a regulatory standpoint. On the one hand, I think innovation is a good thing in our financial system. We shouldn't stand in the way of it. But on the other hand, we got to make sure there's sufficient transparency, that people know what they're getting into, that there's sufficient integrity in the trading, and that there's things like margin and capital and, oversight and things like that to make sure if somebody screws up, it's not going to bring the whole system down. Where should we go next? Yeah. Was there another one over there? Okay. Down here, too. All right. Take a few more.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan Holmes. I work in investment management. Thank you very much for the talk.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the greatest threat to financial stability now is from cyber attacks.
Yeah, in my view, yeah.
I just wondered what your view was on what place regulation can do to minimize that risk.
Yeah, sure. It's a very good question. Well, first I'll tell you what we did, because when I took office, I wanted to focus on this. And we were, at that time, already kind of looking at cyber risk in our examinations. We do examinations of clearinghouses and exchanges to make sure they're complying with our rules. And we were looking at cyber protections because our rules kind of generally said, you know, you got to make sure you've got sound systems and that kind of thing. It was more detailed than that. But so we talked a lot about what we should be doing here. And I didn't want to do something that was simply, you know, kind of a show that we're concerned about it without adding real value here, right? And so what we did was we adopted some rules that require the core infrastructure companies in our markets, meaning the clearinghouses and exchanges and certain others, to routinely test their cyber protections. This is not testing that we do because we don't have the resources to do it, but they do, right? They should already be doing it, and many of them are. And what we did was we said, you've got to be doing these types of testing. For example, controls testing, where you look at what types of controls you have, vulnerability testing, penetration testing, which is where penetration testing means you actually have someone try to break through your defenses, and you keep at it until you break through, right? That's the, you know, because the goal of the test is to figure out what is the place where you can break through, and then you fix that. And there were some other things. And then we said, you know, you should do this according to best practices, and we outlined some current best practices, but we wrote the rule in a way that it can continue to evolve over time. And we also, you know, put in certain requirements about the frequency with which you have to do this. So that's what we did, to basically say, we want to make sure the core infrastructure companies in our markets are routinely and thoroughly doing testing of their own cyber protections. That was the main thing we did. A second thing we did was we enhanced our examinations. We decided, how can our examinations really add value here? Again, we're not going to do testing ourselves. Let's focus on, among other things, this isn't the only thing we do, but we focus on what's going on at the board of directors level in terms of cyber. Are they taking it seriously? How do they respond to an incident? If they have an incident, did they not just fix that particular problem, but did they think about more broadly what else that might mean? You know, is there a committee of the board that is focused on these issues? So that's, you know, one of the things we were looking at more in our examinations. Another thing we're doing, and this is really happening across the board in the U.S. government, it's also happening here in England, is we're trying to create more dialogue between industry and government on cyber threats and possible responses and protections. There's a lot more interchange of information today about that. We've set up mechanisms so that if someone has a cyber incident, they can report that, and it can, and that information can be distributed to others who might be vulnerable to a similar type of attack without revealing confidential information, and to try to do that very quickly. That's very important. We brought industry participants and government officials together. We had all the law enforcement agencies, the regulators. We had the exchanges and clearinghouses and trading companies come together for a long session where we went through a mock scenario of a cyber attack and what would people do in response to that. And that is something that the U.S. government is doing in a lot of areas. So all those things are the type of things we can do. But, you know, this is kind of like an arms race, right? I mean, you heighten your defenses, but then, you know, the hackers heighten their weapons. So you got to keep at it. Got it.
Hello. My name's Sam Wilkes, and I'm a reporter for Risk.net. My question's on position limits. Is the CFTC doing any work to avoid duplicate position limits regimes under
duplicate
the U.S. system?
Duplicate position limits?
The are duplicate position limits. So global commodity firms that have to comply with both EU and US.
Well, again, we don't, you know, we only have today federal limits for agricultural products. We're still in the proposal stage. But, you know, certainly trying to harmonize those is important. We're not even at a point yet in terms of reporting and collecting data, you know, that you could get there. I mean, that's a good question. It's a future goal, but we're kind of not there yet, I think. Yeah. One or two more? Way in the back up there.
Thank you. Tatiana Nikitina from Queen Mary University of London. My question is with the reference to your to the part of your speech about the clearing of, for example, euros in London and dollars here as well. Essentially, as I understand, you mentioned that CFTC has some oversight over CCBs located here. In case bigger and bigger volume and bigger and bigger proportion of contracts denominated in dollars would be cleared outside the US, would you be still comfortable with the toolkit that you have from perspective of oversight rather than supervision, which is, from my perspective, is much weaker mandate?
Well, I guess I wasn't trying to draw a big distinction between oversight and supervision. Let me be clear on that. I mean, what we do with respect to clearinghouses here is, you know, we have the ability, we get regular information, we have the ability to come in and do exams. They have to comply with certain of our rules the way a clearinghouse would have to in the U.S. But we recognize that there is a local regulator, and we work very closely with them. And as I say, insofar as the rules here, in this case EU rules today, potentially UK rules down the road, insofar as those rules are very similar to ours, we say, yeah, show us that you complied with those, and that's fine. So we work very closely with the Bank of England. When we come over, you know, we'll do examinations together. And increasingly, you know, regulators from abroad are coming over and joining us, even though they may not have that same framework. They're joining us in our examinations of clearinghouses in the U.S. So, you know, again, this is, to me, an example of the importance of international cooperation among regulators when you've got a global financial system. I don't know how else we do it. One last question, maybe? Yeah.
I'm an occasional trader.
Question of what?
An occasional trader.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, yes.
In futures and options in UK stock market indices. Could you explain the reasons for the financial regulators to prevent fast crashes?
The reasons for what, I'm sorry?
To prevent fast crashes.
To prevent flash crashes. Well, I don't think we're trying to prevent. Let me put it this way: we're not trying to prevent volatility. We shouldn't try to prevent volatility. Volatility is a natural part of markets. The term flash crash, you know, is now often bandied about, and no one's quite sure what it means. But we are. We will go after people who we think seek to manipulate a market. Now, what does that mean? Well, we recently charged someone who had basically engaged in what we call spoofing over a period of years, including around the time of the flash crash. Spoofing means that you put in lots of orders that you don't intend to consummate in order to try to move the price. And you literally put them in and cancel them a millisecond later. But that effect today in a world of automated trading can drive a price up or down. And this person did that, and we had very clear evidence that he did that, including, because we have to show intent, right? We can't just show a pattern. We got to show that he really intended to do that. And so we actually found an email where he he had some software that he was buying, and he wrote to the supplier, you know, I want to customize this so I can engage in spoofing. So that was very helpful to the case. But this guy, part of his activity was around the time of the flash crash. Now, we didn't say he caused the flash crash, but he contributed to kind of the market conditions, illiquidity in some of the products that kind of contributed to what happened. We went after him. We worked with the Justice Department to go after him, and he's now on his way to prison. So, you know, our goal, again, is not to limit volatility. Volatility is a natural part of markets, but to make sure people don't engage in types of trading that are intended to manipulate markets. So, okay, shall we end it there?
Yes.
It's 8 o'clock.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to listen to you, and also thank you very, very much for taking questions and the audience for coming here and participating. It's been wonderful to have you here at very exciting times.
Great.
And thanks for making time in your busy schedule. And
my pleasure.
For the
thank you. It was fun. Thank you.